Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and with me this week is the wonderful Susanna McIntyre. I can say that, right?
Hello.
Yeah. Susanna is the CEO of Atheist Republic. Atheist Republic is the largest online platform for atheists, agnostics, secularists, whatever, in the world. And how many members are you guys at now?
Oh, my gosh. I need to keep track at this point, but like at least 2.4 million on Facebook, consulates in over 150 countries, like pretty much every major city.
Yeah. So it's going well. It's founded by Armin Navabi, who's not here with us today, but we are. So yeah, we're going to like the episode today is titled "Reason Alone Will Never Defeat Religion." And this is something we've kind of touched on in previous episodes, we really want to get into this time. So let's go. Reason, rationality, logic, facts. You know, as atheists, as agnostics, skeptics, rationalists, we always value the power of rational argument over everything else. You know, we have conferences, you know, we have talks, we're doing all of this, all these lectures, everything's very sort of academic, it's very cerebral. And then we get together and we do these things and we celebrate ourselves. And Sam Harris, actually, when he was doing, I think it was The End of Faith, when he was talking about it, when it first came out, you know, he said that if my reasons, he was talking about rationality, he said, quote, "If my reasons are good enough, you will helplessly believe what I believe, right? If I convince you enough, right? So this is something that I think a lot of people think. I used to believe this too, but this is not the way that it works. And we've kind of learned that through the last 4 or 5 years, you know, when a really powerful demagogue comes into power, you know, you see that it's not really about reason. A lot of it, emotion, which always trumps reason, even in people who are very rationally. So that.
Oh, you just muted yourself.
Yeah, can you hear me now?
It's the wrong mic.
Yeah,
for some reason the system kicked out my mic. You guys,
okay. There we go. Okay, cool. Sorry, yeah. What were you saying?
Yeah, no, so I wanted to I've wanted to talk about this for a while, because I do feel like this is something that it's probably the biggest void in this, you know, if you still want to call it a movement, you know, the atheist movement, the secular movement, is they're missing this one thing. Like, we focus a lot on reason, logic, and rationality and facts, but we're missing a really key element, and that's what we're going to get into today.
Mm-hmm. I think it's even missing in the broader science or science education community, even movement as well.
Yeah, it is. And there are some people who are doing it properly, and, you know, we'll get into this. So I'm going to start with an example, right? So you and I talked about this. Like, supposing you're scrolling down your, and Paul Bloom has talked about this too. You're scrolling down your Instagram feed, just scrolling through your Instagram feed, and you stop and there's a picture of a little girl, like 3-4 years old, really cute. And it says that she's dying of leukemia. And every dollar that you can give will count. Every dollar is going to help. So please donate. You're going to donate. Loads of people are going to donate, right? But if you had something that said, you know, there's a picture of a hospital, that there's a hospital that we have for kids with leukemia, and we need your donations, please donate generously. people will not donate as much. They don't, even though, you know, they have a 200 hospital bed and, you know, it's going to benefit loads and loads of kids like that girl. Why don't they do it? They don't do it because it's, you know, when you have stories, when you create stories, you emotionalize information. So if you have a point to make, right, and you make that point by listing facts, it is not going to resonate with people as much as if you make the same point and tell it as a story. So storytelling emotionalizes information, right? And this is the power of religion. I mean, religion, you know, the Quran, the Bible, the Bhagavad Gita, the, you know, Buddhism, everything is full of stories. There are fables, there are stories, there are, you know, even in non-religious cultures, like Mother Goose, all of these, the morals, the fox and the grapes, all of these things are ways to get information across to people, to educate your kids, to you know, get people to convert to certain ideologies. It's all based on storytelling. And yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, in many ways, it is our oldest way of communicating information, right? Yeah. Like, it's one of our most innate ways of communicating our thoughts and what's going on in our environment, or theorizing about what is going on in our environment. And it's really interesting to look at what's happening cognitively to us while we are hearing a story. I mean, there's so many different fascinating things that take place in our brains when we're hearing a story. Like, you know, the greater, say if there are like two people in an fMRI machine and one of them is telling the story to the other, the person who is listening, the greater their listening comprehension is, the more their brain patterns will actually mirror that of the person who is telling the story. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, it's a very connective experience. And obviously that's highly motivating as social creatures, socially dependent creatures. And then just what happens to us on like a neurochemical and hormonal level when we listen to stories is also super interesting. You know, they can trigger your dopamine and make you happy and increase focus, and or they could, you know, stress you out and get that adrenaline pumping. So, you know, you're super dialed into what's going on because, you know, you're watching something really suspenseful. Or listening to a really suspenseful story, like that cliffhanger just drives our brain crazy because we're pattern finding creatures, right? And so we're like, I'm trying to identify what this pattern is, like what's going to happen, you know?
You just binge stuff, right? And you sit with a book and read it late into the night, even though, you know, in the morning you got to get up. I mean, you don't do that with information. Like, and this is, it extends into politics, it extends into anything. I mean, Bulbul has a comment here and she said just one word, empathy. And that's what it is, Suzanne. Like, you know, you talked about the two guys, the storyteller and the story listener in the fMRI machine, right? And they start mirroring, the person who's listening starts mirroring the mind. It is the best and most effective way to get into the mind of a storyteller. You know, to get fully immersed in their world. And this doesn't just, by story, we're not just talking about books and stories. I mean, I remember the first time I heard the Snoop Dogg's album, like Doggy Style, the very first album he had out.
So good. It's a masterpiece.
It is a masterpiece. And you see there are chapters. And I heard this is a life that he rapped about. And I was hearing about it, and this culture, this life, this stuff from the streets, everything that you're hearing, you know, the guy performed Murder Was the Case, his song Murder from the album, at the MTV Awards while he was out on bail for trial while he was in murder. I mean, he was on trial for murder. This is so it was very real. It was very authentic. And I remember listening to that album, totally becoming immersed in that world. And before, I was sort of distant. I'd read articles about it, you know, so you'd read articles about, you know, all these people, their negative influence on society, you know, the way they refer to the misogyny and all the other stuff that
these gangsters, kids.
And then you hear the album and you put yourself, you get immersed in that world and you understand it. Mm-hmm. You understand that, you know, yes, if I was in that position, if I was raised that way, like, I get it. You know, you connect with them on a human level, even mm-hmm. though your worlds are just miles apart. So, this is the power of, I think, fiction, right? Or fiction storytelling, is that when you put things into a story, you can really connect with the person who's telling it. You can really go into their mind and you can empathize. It's a way of connection that, and this is why we tell stories. That's why religion does it. Like, religion.
And it's so interesting because it plays on so many different parts of our brains. So, like, part of it is that while we're listening to a story, the more detailed it is, the more our brains actually start to activate the regions associated with what's going on that story. So if they're using language like leathery hands or a gravel like voice, you know, the sensory yeah. parts of our brain start to activate as if we are actually experiencing that sensation. And the same thing with words and phrases that are action motivated, you know, like throwing the basketball, running down the block, like our point of reference for that is often self-referential, mm-hmm. right? So to call upon what that is when you're, you know, hearing someone mention this, you draw upon yourself. And so it's almost in the background, our brains are experiencing it vicariously. Right. Or you start thinking about what that would be like if you were doing that, or what that would look like in your environment. Mm-hmm. And this is particularly good for peace building exercises. So there have been a lot of studies on children in the Israeli and Palestinian conflict, or children in Sierra Leone, talking about conflict in their area. And when they were exchanging stories of maybe like fears of persecution, or in the Israeli-Palestinian case, like feeling like I just want to have a place where I can call home. And like, for me, that's this land, you know, they're like, oh, actually that's a feeling I can empathize with. Like, yeah. I feel that way often, you know, like maybe we're actually kind of want the same things. Mm-hmm. And so this is, I think, yeah, like you're saying, why this is so powerful for scripture, especially because scripture is often so aspirational and idyllic. Like it's something that we are meant to aspire to and inspire us to be better and like the greatest versions of ourselves.
Yeah.
Because it's so emotive. But when we're trying to argue people out of thinking religiously, you know, we do try to encourage rationality, critical thinking, like reality testing, empiricism, as ways to build a more objectively observable worldview, which will hopefully lead people to more prosperity and progress.
Yeah.
That actually doesn't move people. And well, I have a lot of thoughts, but I've been
yeah. back for a while. And so, yeah, I do want to get into what we could do. I mean, we're not just going to sit here and just give a diagnosis and talk about how, you know, this is a big void in our movement. We can't do anything, but we are going to, I think at least in the second half of this, try to talk about, you know, what we can do with some of the people who are doing this, and they're bringing elements of storytelling and having an impact in the secular movement. But I do just want to get across this point. I want to talk about the importance of art and storytelling, because art obviously is something that really hits people emotionally. One person or the other. It's an emotional connective medium, right? So, you know, we'll talk about that as well. But there are sort of several other examples. One of them that I wanted to give that I think I've talked about here before is that I'm 46 years old. When I was growing up as a kid in the 80s, early 80s, mid 80s, we were all homophobic. All of us were. We used to use gay slurs, like anti-gay slurs, all the time. It was as normal as using anything else. We used to call each other all the kinds of, you know, names that we don't do. Like we unlearned that, and we now don't do that. But we all grew up that way. And most people in my generation will tell you that we grew up that way. And I remember there was a lot of debate around this. It was debate, right? So someone would write an article in the Wall Street Journal. Someone else would write one in the New York Times. And then they had Andrew Sullivan. I remember was like a Catholic and gay and conservative. He had a Time or Newsweek cover, I think it was Time cover story, saying called The Conservative Case for Gay Marriage. And this was, you know, well ahead of its time that he wrote this. So there were all these sort of debates going on, but people were, how were people processing this information, all this nonfiction, people were writing books about it and everything. They were processing it cerebrally, right? They were processing it with their minds, and we're talking metaphorically, you know, the mind and the heart and all that. We know the heart pumps blood. I get it. All you literal secularists, I understand. But yeah, someone's going to say it, right? So that's how we would process it. And then I remember in the 90s, the Tom Hanks movie Philadelphia came out, right? And in which he played a gay man who had HIV. And because of his diagnosis, he was being pushed out of his job. And then he went to court to fight against, you know, wrongful dismissal. And, you know, he lost a ton of weight for the movie. I think his partner was Antonio Banderas in the movie. And, you know, he couldn't visit him in the hospital. There were so many things. And it was such an emotional movie. You saw that. And it just humanized it. And I remember watching that movie and how it completely transformed my view of everything. I mean, all of these stats you were hearing, all of these conferences and op-eds and books and articles and newspapers.
Yeah, about the epidemic.
You know,
yeah.
You're thinking, you're like, well, this guy's got a point. That guy's got a point. And it was okay. But when we saw that movie, which is fiction, it didn't actually happen. It's not real. And you watch it and you see the experience and you get into the mind of the storyteller and you put yourself into their shoes and into the shoes of the characters that you're seeing. And you emotionally connect with them. It's transformative. Like it does something to you. It makes you feel things. And making people feel things is incredibly important. And it can be, it's dangerous too. I mean, it's something demagogues use. I mean, we're not supposed to say it on YouTube, right? But the World War II guy, the guy, A.H., like,
ridiculous. Adolf.
Yeah. Adolf. You can't say, can you do that? No, okay.
You can call him Adolf.
I guess so. So this guy, like he popularized the political rally, right? And that's why demagogues love political rallies. Because his whole idea was that when you have people chanting slogans together in unison, then, you know, they're in a heightened emotional state. They're all bonding on very basic sort of non-thinking terms. Like once you get them to feel things, they stop thinking. When you can get them to feel things really strongly, you know, they turn their minds off. And when they turn their minds off, you can package anything you want to in that emotional sort of vehicle that you're sending to them, and they will absorb it, right? Mm-hmm. And Bulbul's saying, yeah, Modi does that too. Modi does it. Donald Trump did it, right? And so here's another example of...
I mean, to be fair, like, now people across every political party in the world probably have political rallies.
You have to. Yeah, you have, because that's what's effective. I mean, if you don't, you're going to lose. And so some people don't actually. Some people did not wise up to it. Like, for example, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in 2016. Hillary Clinton had a lot of good points. But her points, the format they took were, she was a policy wonk, so she would list them out. He's like, well, this is what we're going to do for healthcare. This is how we're going to, you know, pay down the national debt. This is whatever. And it was like bullet points that she was just narrating these bullet points. They were all very correct. They're very well thought out. They were the right thing to do in most cases. But she didn't have a story. And when Donald Trump came out and he said, you know, make America great again. We're going to build a wall. We're going to ban Muslims. We're going to keep these people out. And that's a story. That's something that people could emotionally connect with. And yeah. Those are slogans that he gave them that they could yell out at rallies. I mean, there was a cohesive story that people could rally around, and that resonated with people. So, I mean, that's what I think stories win out. Emotion does win out over reason. Like, if you want to persuade people, if you're in the art of persuasion, then emotionality trumps reason almost 100% of the time.
Well, yeah, it's actually partially, I'm not even partially, a large part, unconscious part of how we make decisions as well.
Right.
So emotionally, like a lot of the decision-making process will first like come through the amygdala in many ways. And then after you've emotionally made this decision, then the other parts of the brain come in that kick in and rationalize what yeah. you're doing to fit into your worldview. And yeah. that's super important because it you can hijack yeah. someone's decision-making that way. Which we can see as D is seeing fear is especially useful. Yeah.
Fear.
Yeah. Obviously fear motivates a great wealth of our actions this and our decisions.
Yeah. This is a really good point, D. You know, when you talk about fear, what's really interesting is that if you just look at these political campaigns, and you gave the example of Donald Trump, and then you look at the example of Barack Obama, who's also incredibly charismatic, and he also won the election, you know, massively, and even though the odds were against him, right? But he had the message of hope. So hope yeah. and fear, interestingly, are very similar because they're both sort of anticipatory emotions, right? They're almost the same thing in a way, right? So you kind of, you know, when you're fear of the unknown, you don't know what's going to happen next, and you're fearing it. And hope is just the positive flip side to that, where, you know, you don't know what's going to happen in the future,
but you're looking forward to it.
You're looking forward to something. You're hoping for something good. So both whenever you have that and you have this relationship that you create within people, a relationship with the unknown, a relationship with the uncertain, right, then you can really, really play on that. And you can use that to manipulate them in all kinds of ways. So hope and fear. I mean, if you look at politicians, generally you have the really inspiring, you know, hope-filled activists and politicians, or you have like the fear-mongering, you know, this, if you don't vote for me, this is what's going to happen. You know, it's going to be a disaster. It's going to be a dystopia. You have those kinds of people. So both of these things are very useful. And
I think storytelling is particularly useful within activism. It's almost a prerequisite. You have to be able to tell the story of what your cause is. Yeah. And one of the best ways to do this is through like character profiles, essentially. So like for me, I'm really passionate and interested in like blasphemy and anti-blasphemy, or no, it would be a blasphemy law. And, you know, I'm like a huge nerd on this. I'm really interested in the statistics, you know, how many countries have these, how many use them, who are they mostly enforced against, like who's mostly persecuted by these things, like all this stuff. And, but if I start going through like a use riff report with someone over blasphemy, they're going to be like, this isn't really that interesting, Susanna. Yeah. But if you start to tell someone the story of like someone who's being persecuted for their blasphemy, like Sohail Al-Arabi in Iran, you know, his story, or Raif Badawi and what he's gone through, and, you know, to show also like the family members of these people, you know, telling their story, and it makes it so much more real and it personalizes it. And then it makes you empathize and you think, oh, wow. Like that would be totally insane if that happened to me. Like, I can't believe this happens to people and people go through this. Like, we should talk about this more so people would be more aware about how, you know, important free speech is and stuff like this. Like it's so perfect at illustrating a point.
Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting for me to consider within like the broader ex-Muslim movement, because I think there has been a lot of work put in over the past, like definitely 5 years and longer, of really illustrating and painting out like the broad spectrum and diversity of ex-Muslims and their stories. Because obviously there was a long period of time where people were not, they felt too scared and threatened to share their story of apostasy, right? But now, you know, there's ex-Muslims like all over Twitter, all over TikTok, Instagram, like they'll tell their story, they'll profile it. Like it's a lot more destigmatized to tell the story of apostasy from Islam in many ways. And to find other people sharing their stories. Whereas previously, I mean, this still happens, but people are like, I've never, you know, even heard of X Muslim, like, until, you know, this year. And I feel like that might happen less and less now. But given that there's been so much effort, I mean, obviously you were a huge contributor to that with this show, Secular Jihadist, and like the great depth of the early catalog. There's a lot of spending a lot of time doing those individual profiles. Do you think telling individual stories is still a priority within like your ex-Muslim activism, or are you more interested in broader issues at this point now that there's more representation?
I think that storytelling, I think it's as important as ever, and we should continue doing it. I think that we tell a lot of stories, we've gone through it, so we think that, okay, that stuff is done, now we can move on to something else. But the fact is that they're just as powerful for new people who are being exposed to this as they were before. I mean, just because we have become desensitized or, you know, become used to it, doesn't mean that they don't have the same kind of impact on people who are hearing it for the first time. And there is a risk of, you know, when you do come out as a storyteller, you're telling a story, and then after that, you start getting into sort of conjecture and more sort of cerebral conversations. You do lose some of that mojo, some of that emotional mojo. And there are examples, like Ayaan Hirsi Ali is a great example of someone who, you know, she wrote her story Infidel, which is completely consistent with everything she thinks right now. But it was a story beginning to end, and people immersed themselves in it. And every liberal, every progressive who read that story was floored by it. They thought it was a masterpiece, and it was a masterpiece. Infidel's like probably one of the best books you're ever going to read. And then what happened is, like, I mean, she started getting more political. She started, you know, talking about her points of view in a non-storytelling context, you know, just debate, conversation,
commentary,
academics, commentary. Yeah. And suddenly, you know, it became a lot more polarizing. Then people weren't feeling it anymore. You know, they're trying to analyze it, and they're trying to poke holes, and they're trying to, you know, debate her points. So there's an example where the control group is actually built right into, you know, the public figure who initially did the story.
Yeah, so it's really interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny. I'm very, I try to be very self-reflective. And so when I had my de-awokening, as I call it, exiting the woke mentality, for those who are not familiar, who Ali himself is definitely partially responsible for, in fact. I was really critical of the quote unquote woke for holding up lived experience as kind of the end all be all form of legitimate testimony. And, you know, it almost seemed like greater trends and statistics didn't even matter in comparison to like what so-and-so said they went through, you know? And I really started to come to resent that and putting like, quote, like lived experience up on this pedestal of like something that you can't question, something that you can't challenge, that is like just as legitimate of a way of reaching conclusions as like a freaking meta-analysis.
that
really started to bother me. But then, you know, when I was thinking about this episode, I was realizing that I fooled myself. Like, what changed my mind on that issue was hearing the story of Yasmin Muhammad and the abuse she went through and what happened with a court case regarding it being completely mishandled. Because, you know, the judge basically said, oh, well, that's what like your people, meaning like your Egyptian
Muslim,
like, ethnically family. Yeah, but that's what they do. So like, I can't really say anything about it. Right. And that story was like a twig snapping in my brain. Like, I completely understood in that instance, like the problem of just cultural relativism that I had completely bought into because I took critical studies in university.
That's a great example. That's a really,
And I just realized today, I was like, wait, Susanna, you did the exact thing you were criticizing. Like, you heard the story of someone's lived experience and it put things into perspective for you and you changed your mind.
Yeah. Look, you know, it's in, and it's not a matter of, it depends what you do with it. Like, if you're taking people's lived experience and using it as data or using it as something that's representative of a massive phenomenon out there, then yeah, you're right. I mean, it doesn't work. But, you know, when I'm talking about Philadelphia and how it sort of changed my mind, the movie, that movie isn't even a lived experience. I mean, that was a purely fiction thing. So it's operating on a different realm. It's not about the evidence. It's about when you're talking about changing hearts and minds, you know, yeah, you can present data and you can present. I mean, we know what's going on with this whole, you know, this the big thing that's going around, the big illness.
the thing that makes you sick. Yeah.
We can't talk about. But, you know, all of these theories, all these conspiracy theories, they're stories and they're convincing to people. And you can throw fact after fact after fact at them. You can show them studies of like millions and millions of people, like real world evidence. Right. And it's not going to, they're not going to budge because it's like Life of Pi, you know, the book Life of Pi or the movie Life of Pi. Yeah. Have you seen it or read it?
I've read it.
So, you know, I'm going to spoil the ending now, but, you know, at the end, you know, he's like, you know, what if this wasn't the story? I just told you about me and the tiger and, you know, all this about. He's like, what if that wasn't the story? What if the story was just that, okay, I just got on this boat and I was discovered and it was, I can't remember exactly, but it was
More brutal than that, Ollie. It's way more brutal than that. There was like cannibalism involved on that boat.
Yeah, yeah. There's all kinds. So he said, which story would you like to believe? And he's like, well, I would believe the one about that. He's like, because we like interesting stories. We like stories that are more dramatic, that sort of fit our, you know, they excite us. They make us interested. They inspire us. And we choose those stories. Mm-hmm. You know, even the most rational and the most reasoned of us, we still choose those stories. So, so just quickly about the art aspect. You know, art is extremely important. And I think that we sometimes neglect it a lot. You know, like when we're talking about filmmaking, we're talking about stand-up comedy, we're talking about music, painting. I mean, again, look at the example. If you want to fight religion, look at what religion does. Religion tells stories. It takes its ideas, the morals, like whatever they want to get across, they do it through storytelling. And what is that storytelling? What is all of the symbols? It's full of symbols. It's full of secret. You know, like what you have in cults, you have your own handshakes. You have your own greetings.
Yeah. Loaded language is what it's called.
Loaded language.
Insider language. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, you have your own group, little, the way that you shake hands, the way you greet each other, what you say, assalamu alaikum, when you meet somebody, like, you know, it becomes like an exclusive thing within that group. That makes you feel closer, like you're part of that community. And that's how cults are created, and cults eventually become religions. And art is a huge part of that. I mean, you go to the Vatican, you've got those four rooms painted by Raphael. One was painted by a student, but still, whatever, he took credit for it. There's the roof of the Sistine Chapel, all the sculptures, you know, the Michelangelo sculpts, the architecture, like in churches, the choirs, the music, right? Gospel and everything. There's in Islam, right? Islam, you know, they're like, okay, we don't like doing music. The azan is music. The prayer call is music.
True.
You can play it on the guitar.
Recitation of the Quran.
Recitation of the Quran is done musically. And what is the Quran? The Quran is written in poetry.
In poetry.
Right? It's written in poetry. You do tilawa, you recite it in a musical way that. And people listen to it and they get teary-eyed and they cry. I mean, you listen to, again, Sam Harris had an article that he wrote about, you know, mysticism of religion, how he listens to Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, who is a Pakistani Qawwali singer who sings, you know, religious songs. They're songs that praise Allah and Muhammad. And Sam Harris is listening to this shit in the gym, right?
While that sounds like something I would would do.
And he's getting into it. He's loving it. And I do too. Like I listen to that stuff too. Richard Dawkins has talked about, you know, the beauty of literature and the beauty of the art, you know, all of this that we got from Christianity and Islam. You also have the architecture. I mean, you have calligraphy. Calligraphy is another art form. So there are many, like these artistic media, the Shia, you know, what do the Shia do? To try to get people on to the concept of jihad and sacrificing your life, you know, for Islam is you've got that Muharram period of mourning where Hussein and his whole family was sacrificed, you know, for the sake of the faith. And then they mourn and they tell these stories, and these stories are sad.
Can Susanna, I tell you something hilarious?
What?
I've never been a Muslim in my life, but I was listening to a Shia lecture. Yeah. And one of the stories from Karbala actually made me cry.
That's what I'm trying to tell you. That's what they do.
I am a Shia.
There you go. You guys heard it here.
Listen to the lecture, Eileen. All the people in the recording are crying at the same time.
The CEO of Atheist Republic, the largest online atheist platform in the world, was moved to tears by the story of Karbala. There you go. You heard it here first.
Everyone knows. It's true. Uh-huh.
But you know, this is the thing. It's powerful. Storytelling mixed with art is a lethal combination. It has a chokehold on the hearts and minds of billions of people thousands of years after these things were made up. No matter how scientific the world got, you know, Kepler came and went, Galileo came, like all this stuff. The world is operating on science. It's operating on science. Everybody, these people are using science to get their religious stories across, right? They're using it. They're using the internet. They're using their phones. They're using microphones, everything. But you know, they won't let go of those stories. They won't let go of conspiracy. So it's just a very, very powerful tool, and it's missing in the secular movement. We're not doing it enough.
That leads me to my question for you, which is like, how would we tell better stories? So I've been thinking about this in the realm of, like, you know, I'm thinking specific topics. So obviously, if you wanted to get kids interested in science, like maybe you would tell them a story about like what would happen if you fell into a black hole or something. Mm-hmm. But then if I'm thinking in terms of atheism, I have a harder time coming up with a story. I can think of telling the story of maybe why someone decided to leave their religion, mm-hmm. but telling a story about like non-belief itself, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. You don't think of it when you're telling stories, you're not thinking of things super literally, right? You are thinking of what you said, falling into a black hole. Like I'll tell you, and I wrote about this in my book, which you know is that there are master storytellers, right, in the atheist movement. That we've seen, Stephen Hawking was one of them. You know, when I read A Brief History of Time, you know, you have all the creation myths, you've got Adam and Eve, you've got Genesis, you know, all that stuff. And there's beautiful stories, so people buy into them, right? And then you have, you know, you had the Big Bang Theory, which everybody was explaining very factually. And then Stephen Hawking came and explained it in a beautiful way. You know, he said, well, What happened before the Big Bang? It's like the question doesn't make sense, because if you're on the North Pole, you can't go north of the North Pole. If the Big Bang was the beginning of time, then the question of what happened before, like before, is just not a concept if time doesn't exist. There's no such thing as before. So the question itself is wrong. It's like looking for an edge on a spherical world, or, you know, trying to go north of the North Pole. So he would explain things that way. And you know, he would use stories to tell this. And then there was Carl Sagan in the Cosmos series. It's full of stories. I mean, that's one of the 1980s version of Cosmos that Carl Sagan did is one of the most phenomenal, just artistic, scientific achievements of all time. You know, he, when he wanted to, I don't know if you know this, Susanna, but he had this I think it's probably on YouTube. You probably find it somewhere. He had this little segment about Flatland, right? Where he wanted to explain how four-dimensional objects would appear to people who live in a three-dimensional world, right? So what he did was he tried to show, he created this place called Flatland, which was a two-dimensional world. And then he was taking three-dimensional objects and passing them through it and saying, well, okay, so these are the people who live on Flatland, and here's how they're seeing this. You know, I remember when he, there's this one part in his, in one of the episodes, he was talking about traveling near the speed of light. So he showed this guy who got on a motorcycle, and he's like, let's say he's traveling near the speed of light. So let's see what happens. Well, first of all, everything that's in front of him will already be behind him by the time he sees it, you know, all these other things. And then he comes back, and he basically left. He went out for 5 minutes, and he comes back, and his brother, who was sitting on the bench where he left, is now 76 years old. You know, and he's only aged 5 minutes. So things like that, like when you saw those stories as a kid, even though I didn't completely understand all of it, I was floored. It won me over. It made the science more interesting to me than all of the, you know, let there be light and then there was light type thing.
It's interesting to think about in terms of like science education. Because I know that's a big push that people are making to try to keep kids interested in science. Because oftentimes I think Neil deGrasse Tyson has a good quote about how like the curiosity is like squeezed out of kids like by the time mm-hmm. they get to school. Yeah.
He's another one of them, by the way. Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah, Richard Dawkins. Incredible. But, you know, it's kind of interesting for me just based on my background is you can have a story that makes science interesting, but then actually doing science, yeah. It's not always very interesting.
That's a good. So, you know, that so that has been addressed is, you know, like when you're doing an art appreciation course or you're doing a degree in art appreciation or music appreciation, cultural appreciation, it's whatever. You don't actually have to go and do the art or learn the music. Right? You can just have an appreciation. So why not? And this is something Richard Dawkins brought up too. It's like, why can't we have science appreciation courses? Right? Instead of, because a lot of people, they avoid science because they think that, you know, they don't want to go into the fucking lab and, you know, start using test tubes and, you know, writing, making lab notes and things like that, because
it's
not everybody wants to do it.
It's the formulas that get me, man.
Yeah, a lot of people don't want to do it. They don't want to do it. And it's not fun. You know, it's the fact that, you know, if you want to study anything else, you can just go and just really immerse yourself in the topic and learn about it. When you want to do science, you actually have to go in and do the stuff. It's annoying for people. So we could have that. We could have science appreciation, degrees or programs in universities where you could do that. And you know, those people could become teachers. They can go into academics. I mean, there's a lot that they can do with it. And so you can do this with the truth. You can do this with reality. I mean, one of Richard Dawkins' books is The Magic of Reality, right? Where, again, just masterful storytelling. He has taken evolution and he's able, you know, by turning it into stories in The Greatest Show of Earth, on Earth, that book. He has, or you know, what he did in The Selfish Gene. I mean, he's just a master storyteller of facts, factual phenomena, and he's able to tell those stories. The physicists have been doing a really good job of this. So these are things that I think we can do, and we kind of have to get away from this sort of format of everybody coming together for a conference and putting their minds together. And we're doing podcasts like this, but you know, even it's good. Like the conferences are good, the podcasts are good, all this stuff is fine. But you know, maybe also have you know, talent showcases. Maybe have, you know, stand up comedy. Like so much stand up comedy, Suzanne, is based on, like, if you look at Ricky Gervais, like there's a lot of atheists in stand-up comedy. There's a lot of people who ridicule religion. Yeah. George Carlin used to do it. Mm-hmm. And he has some amazing clips on this stuff. Bill Maher does it. You know, he made a whole movie about it. And it's very, very effective. You notice that the vast majority of people in George Carlin's audience were religious people because it was an American audience. And this is back in the 70s and 80s. Obviously, these people were fucking religious. But when he would talk about it, he would make them laugh. And he would draw them in. He'd bring them in. He'd open them up to the idea.
Laughter is particularly important because it will like let people's guards down. about something that they're usually very protective or defensive over. Right. But if you already have them laughing, you're like, okay, this is harmless. Like, yeah, you can poke fun at what I hold dear. I know that this is something you've been thinking about for a long time and actually working towards. Like, you have a project that you're working on. You're such a good storyteller. I just have to tell the audience that the separate project is a screenplay that Ali is working on, and just him summarizing the story of the screenplay actually made me cry.
Like Karbala. I'm right up there like with Karbala. Me, Ali, and Karbala, we moved Susanna so much that she cried. Yeah,
exactly. So I want you to tell people about what you're working on.
Yeah. I'm not going to talk about the screenplay because that's just, I'll tell you, I got to give a shout out right now to Leslie Rosenblood, because every time I start, you know what it's like when you ask a writer about their book and they just keep going on and on and on about it. So he made me much less annoying by writing this sort of elevator pitch, like, you know, what would appear on the back of the book. So I'll just read that out to you guys. But I just want to preface this by saying that, yeah, I wrote a nonfiction book called, you know, The Atheist Muslim. And what's interesting is that Publishers Weekly, when they wrote the review of it, one of their criticisms was that, you know, sometimes he retreats, or, you know, goes into anecdote and starts telling stories. You know, he doesn't stick to the facts, and they found that annoying. A lot of other people found that interesting. Jerry Coyne actually agreed with Publishers Weekly. He's like, yeah, you know, sometimes he goes away from the facts, starts telling stories. But I did that very deliberately because of this. And since then, since the last 4 years, when we've had so much nonfiction, so much Twitter, and so much just everybody writing books and articles, it just got insane. I switched to fiction, right? So here it is. Sorry, I'm just going to read this out the way that Leslie wrote it. Hi, Leslie, if you're listening, I'll send this to you. So this is the book. I don't have a title for it. But it says, okay, the latest thriller from Ali Rizvi. So the Quran is the eternal unchanging word of Allah, absolute and inerrant, since it was first written 1300 years ago, or so we have been told. Okay. Then the character, let's call him Ali. Ali is a Pakistani-Canadian high school teacher of history whose life has just been turned upside down. After his burying his parents after a tragic accident, he finds some kind of document indicating that the man who raised him was not his father. He decides to travel his father was last seen in Yemen, to Yemen to uncover the truth. But instead of what Ali believes will be a 2-week vacation, his search to find his true origins leads to uncovering a conspiracy larger than he could have ever imagined. Is his father still alive? Why did he abandon Ali as a baby? Has his father been in hiding all these years because he has knowledge others will kill to keep secret? Or is he suffering from paranoid delusions? As Ali draws closer to finding his father, he uncovers truths involving forged Quranic manuscripts and historical lies told for the acquisition of power and influence, while a global political assassination squad will go to any lengths to suppress what Ali has learned. The lives of billions will never be the same if he survives. There you go. He's good, right? Leslie's amazing. That's it.
Good. It up.
Yeah. So,
I want to know what happens right now.
That's essentially the book. It has to do with the Sana manuscript. It has to do with a history professor in exile, and it has to do with this explosive thing about Islamic history. That is actually a known, recognized theory, or you know. Alternative kind of history.
The standard narrative
holes in it. Yeah. So, and it's like the Da Vinci Code. So let's, you know, here's another example of where fiction just trumps nonfiction all the time, because again, it emotionalizes information. The Da Vinci Code was just a thriller. It got everything you're talking about, Susanna, the adrenaline pumping, got people excited, cliffhangers, all of that shit, right? So it's amazing. But in the background, you know, you had this story. And you had the story that had components that there were loads of books, nonfiction books written about, like the Knights Templar and Opus Dei, and, you know, the alternative, the feminine, I guess, you know, how there's a feminine sort of nucleus in Christianity, that alternative history of Christianity. And that was all kind of in the background. It was happening, but it was, you know, the main story was these guys like solving puzzles and trying to find the Holy Grail, right? Just a classic thriller. And all the other stuff is just kind of peppered in. And that actually popularized that alternative narrative of Christianity way more in the general public than any of those academic books mm-hmm. and nonfiction books and conferences or whatever they may have had. So people came out, they're writing all these books against the Da Vinci Code debunked, and you know, all this. People were really, really triggered by it, and they were really upset by it. It's a fictional book, you know? And I love things like that. And I wanted to, that's kind of what this book, like what my book that I'm writing is modeled. It's based on a legitimate alternative history of Islam that there's a lot of evidence for within Islamic, like the Islamic documents, within the Quran, within the Hadith. There's a lot of evidence for, and it's in the background. The main story though is a universally relatable story of a kid trying to find his father. Like, who's mm-hmm. my real father? I want to find my origins. And as he gets closer to finding his father, he also gets closer to debunking, you know, this whole thing that he's been taught about his religion. So it's, I just thought it would be a lot more fun. It's a lot more fun to research. It's a lot more fun to write. There's a lot of legitimate Islamic history in it. There's a lot of facts I can kind of expose, like the, with Abdullah Gondal, we had him on the podcast talking about
the different versions of the Quran. His presentation, about Quranic variation was so good.
Yeah, so it was incredible. So, you know, all of that will come into play, and it'll be just presented in the background. Oh, by the way, you know, there's this thing here too, right? So it's that's what I love.
Oh, by the way, everything you were taught is a lie.
Yeah, but I want more. I think that especially whether it's ex-Muslims, ex-Christians, whoever it is out there who's listening to this, you know, try it to be creative. Try to tell those stories. Mm-hmm. You know, do the George Carlin thing, you know, what he did with comedy, you know, disarm the audience.
You know what? I'll be really excited when we get major media representation of an ex-Muslim story. Mm-hmm. Like, if there was a Netflix series about, like, a young girl like leaving Islam, like mm-hmm. in Australia or something, that'd be so interesting. Like, I think we're just starting to get to a place where we have more just like Muslim stories in Western media. But I feel like they are very careful and kind of PC mm-hmm. in many ways to like be like, oh, this isn't so bad, or it kind of whitewashes issues sometimes. And I don't think I've ever seen a series or a movie or anything that actually shows like these characters leaving the faith mm-hmm. and actually in depth, like what that could mean to someone and the cost of their community. Yeah. And I'm really looking forward to more of those stories coming forward. Like if there was like the story of, you know, someone who left like a Salafist fundamentalist family, like, you know, that's very similar in some ways to the Unorthodox, you know, on Netflix, which just blew up, you know, leaving an ultra-Orthodox Hasidic community and like mm-hmm. how it can just turn your life upside down and starting from zero. And I think that would really capture a lot of people, and I would be in the background losing my mind because that'd be so exciting.
That is proud. Like, imagine if, you know, Infidel from Ayaan Hirsi Ali, like if you took that, and even though that's a nonfiction memoir, right, but it is a story, it's a powerful story. If they took that and they had like a fictionalized version of it that they turned into a TV series, it would be phenomenal.
Yeah.
Right. It's and it's not, it wouldn't be a liberal thing, wouldn't be a conservative thing, wouldn't be anything. I mean, now I guess people know her, so it might be, but you know what I mean? I mean, mm-hmm. it would just be a great story that people could connect to. And you're right. And so there are a couple of things that have been like that. Like Kumail Nanjiani, he wrote The Big Sick, right? Which was, he was nominated for an Oscar, him and his wife,
that's
Emily.
That's right. Yeah.
For the best original screenplay and just highly, highly reviewed. I think it's got like 98% on Rotten Tomatoes, just incredibly critically acclaimed movie. And you know, it was a very similar kind of thing. In the background, he was this guy from Pakistan, right? He had a Pakistani family. His mother was trying to get him married. She would say, you know, listen, go pray. And he'd go in the basement and play video games and watch YouTube videos and avoid it because he just didn't know. He was very confused about his whole religion thing, didn't know if he believed in it. You know, he's in love with a white girl who's not Muslim. He's having premarital sex. He's having beers. He's doing all of that stuff. They're showing like a classic, a pretty typical, you know, secular Muslim or
secular
guy.
Muslim in the West.
Yeah. So he's doing that. And then he has arguments with his father about, you know, his father's like at one point, he's like, you don't believe in Allah. And he's like, I don't know. So there are dialogues like that in the movie. And it's all sort of in the background showing this sort of identity crisis and where do I belong type thing. But the main story is a universally relatable, you know, my girlfriend's sick, she's going to die. What am I going to do? Right. Mm-hmm. That's something everybody can relate to. Like that, that's the overarching thing. And then in the background, you have all these other things. Aziz Ansari, who did Master of None, the TV show. Mm-hmm. I think in the second season, he has an episode called Religion. It's called Religion, where, you know, he's the Muslim kid and he used to go to his friend's house and he just started eating bacon and it was fucking amazing. And he started eating pork, but he couldn't order it when he's out to dinner with his family. So that also explores the whole thing. Aziz Ansari is also a declared atheist. You know, he's an ex-Muslim, pretty much. You know, Muslim family, but he's an atheist. So there are a few things like that out there that have been really good at the way they've been presented. But we definitely need more.
Dee is asking a very good question. Guys, this is a reminder that if you are a patron, you can watch these episodes live and ask your questions live or comment on Patreon ahead of time if you can't make the live stream. So, you know, consider supporting for as little as $1 a month. Dee is asking, do you think personal stories of ex-Muslims will trump scientific errors in the Quran as far as people leaving the faith? I'll pitch this to you, Ali, since you are the ex-Muslim here.
No, I'd love to hear what you think too, but I would say yes. I think that personal stories anywhere in it, when it comes to anything, scientific errors, usually like they appeal to me because I have a science education. They may appeal to a lot of other people in this community because, you know, they're more scientifically oriented. So that could work, but for just generally out in the public realm, personal stories of anybody, you know, if you hear about ex-Muslims, you think of all these Islamophobes, you know, they're traitors, they're, you know, native informants, you know, all this other crap. But when you see these personal stories of what they went through and you see that they're human beings just like anybody else, you know, they have lives, they care about their kids, you know, they fall in love, they go through heartbreak. They go through all of the human things, that human experience that you do too. And you hear their stories and you connect with them and you're immersed into their world and you see things from their point of view. There is a connection there that is just so organic and so human that I think it would trump any kind of connection you could have with, ooh, well, you know, embryology in the Quran, is it really?
Yeah. I think from kind of an outsider perspective, I think the stories of ex-Muslims for non-Muslims will go far longer in communicating to other people some of the problems in Islam, like the harm it can cause, and also why it's worthy of criticism, like openly. I think that will go a long way in convincing non-Muslims or never Muslims to get interested in this topic and to not treat it as something that's untouchable, because I feel like criticism of Islam is in still many places, like very untouchable. And in terms of the scientific errors in the Quran, well, when I think of like an ex-Muslim, and this is just a person, I don't mean like an ex-Muslim. I'm kind of speculating here, but I'm thinking like, you know, hearing the story of what someone else went through might not necessarily move someone, because the excuse you hear all the time was like, your parents were just using Islam the wrong way. You know, like, that's, I'm sorry that that happened to you, but that's not representative of the religion. And, you know, it's just an abuse of the scripture, and this isn't really real Islam. And so, like, I think we've all heard that kind of mentality and those excuses. So I can see how someone who is a believer might kind of brush that stuff off. But if they're actually pointed out more specific flaws or inconsistencies or things that they actually never knew were contained within the scripture that is supposed to be this perfect, aspirational, untouchable, unquestionable thing, I think that might actually move more people closer to doubt and criticism than just the story of an individual who you could say, well, you know, you didn't apply this the right way, instead of being like, oh, actually what's fundamentally here has these huge holes in it that I never knew about before. And so I need to actually go back and re-examine kind of what I've bought into.
Yeah.
I think it kind of depends on the type of person you are and what you respond to. And also maybe to an extent your background. So I get the impression that the way like someone from a Salafist background might approach it might be like very different from someone who has less of a literalist fundamentalist background. Like if you come from a background that is less absolutist, you might not be as likely to have kind of this like watershed nail in the coffin moment, because you're more used to kind of conceptualizing and thinking your way around things versus like, no, this is the way it is. But when you have an absolutist mindset and then you can have like one crack in that absolution, like the whole thing can come crashing down.
Yeah.
Did that make sense? Or what do you think about that?
No, I think that makes complete sense. Like it does. There's a lot in here about, you know, how people connect to things, right? That's eventually, I think, what it comes down to, like what people connect to and how they connect to it. But I'll say another thing about the scientific errors, D, is that, you know, we've got, you know, when you look at all the conspiracy theories nowadays, I mean, everybody's seeing it with this big illness that is going around, the big illness. It's
the big sick.
It's the big sick that's going around. It's, I met, you know, one of the guests at my daughter's birthday party last weekend is a nurse, you know, one of her, just a wonderful person, nurse, healthcare professional, hasn't been vaccinated because she doesn't know. She doesn't believe in vaccinations. I know physicians, you know, vaccine hesitance.
Wait, we can't talk about this, Ali.
Huh? Oh, sorry. Crap. Did I say it?
Oh, crap. We might have to cut this out on the
audio. Okay. Yeah. Let's beep it out. I'm sorry. I apologize. I shouldn't have said it, but yeah. So there are, you know, there are people, educated people who are in the profession who buy into these things. So, you know, because there's an emotional story, there's an emotional narrative that they have that they want, like, you know, like you said, that they want to fit everything into,
mm-hmm.
right? So facts and, you know, just scientific accuracy, all of these things, they operate in the background, but they don't move people. They don't mm-hmm. they're not going to change hearts and minds the way that, say, Donald Trump is.
Yeah. Well, this was a super interesting topic. We have come to the top of the hour. So yeah, guys, please consider supporting the show. Please make sure to like this, share like the clips of this video or the audio version, and subscribe, tune in for more. There's some juicy topic suggestions that I gave you guys that are coming up that I think would be very good.
I like those. I think they're gonna be a lot of fun.
Yeah,
so it's cool. Gonna be an interesting idea. I'd like sort of things like this as well, just sort of exploratory things. I mean, these are fun to do from time to time, you know, some more abstract stuff. But yeah, everybody, thank you very much. Hit the subscribe button so that you can be notified every time we make more videos like this. Did you say all this stuff? Did you already say it?
Yeah, basically. No? It's fine.
Yeah.
Just double the reminder, guys. Don't forget.
Yeah. Let's hit the subscribe button. And yeah, thank you. I mean, this was a lot of fun. Thank you. And, you know, I guess, yeah, we'll see you next time. We'll see you next week.
Yes. See you next time.
The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadist.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.